Go ahead and turn to Hebrews chapter 6. Hebrews chapter 6. Hebrews 6. Now, to do a short recap, last week we talked about the first part of chapter 6, verses 1 through 12. And as we went through verses 1 through 12, if you recall, I told you that these were probably some of the most difficult verses in Hebrews, probably some of the more difficult verses in the New Testament, maybe even in the entire Bible. There's a lot of places that's tough. Hebrews 6 is one of those. And the reason it was so tough was because it said, for one, that it was impossible for somebody who had been enlightened and had tasted the Holy Spirit and have shared in these things to be restored again to repentance. We talked a little bit about the unpardonable sin and what that looked like and the scariness and the seriousness of the warning that he issues there in chapter 6. But if you recall, one of the options for interpreting chapter 6, the beginning of chapter 6, was to say that we're able to lose our salvation. And plenty of people have said that from they reading the first part of chapter 6. They've gone through and they said, well, this sounds like somebody who's obviously been saved. It's using all the right language. And now they've fallen away from it, which is losing the salvation. And he says, you can't get resaved, right? And so they read that. That's what they say. We didn't go there, right? We concluded that this was people that may have heard the gospel, may have even embraced a part of it, enjoyed it, received it with joy, but never truly submitted their life to Christ. They fully knew what it meant to follow him, and then they fully rejected him. That's where we landed. But the reason was because the idea of losing your salvation is contradicted throughout a lot of the scriptures, and one of the best places it's contradicted is verses 13 through 20, the last part of this chapter. And so you'll see where I'm getting the title from when I say something God can't do. I couldn't pass up on saying that, and you'll see it in this text as we read Hebrews chapter 6, verse 13. For when God made a promise to Abraham, since he had no one greater by whom to swear, he swore by himself, saying, surely I will bless you and multiply you. And thus Abraham, having patiently waited, obtained the promise. For people swear by something greater than themselves, and in all their disputes an oath is final for confirmation. So when God desired to show more convincingly to the heirs of the promise the unchangeable character of his purpose, he guaranteed it with an oath. So that by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have fled for refuge might have a strong encouragement to hold fast to the hope set before us. We have this as a sure and steadfast anchor of the soul, a hope that enters into the inner place behind the curtain, where Jesus has gone as a forerunner on our behalf, having become a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Now, the first thing we want to talk about here is the unchanging person of God, the unchanging person of God. Where am I getting this? So let's look at what he just said, right? He says he made a promise to Abraham, but because he had no one greater by whom to swear, he swore by himself. Now, this is a thing, I don't know if you ever got in trouble for this as a kid. I know I did. Probably a lot of kids do. What would they do? What would they say? They get into an argument with somebody, or maybe they're even talking to their parent, and you're calling them out for lying. You know, did you take that? Did you break that lamp? And they say, no, I didn't. And they may, I say, swear to God, right? And then somebody would pop them and say, hey, don't do that, right? Because that's serious, right? We take an oath when we're in the courtroom. They still take oaths. And they're swearing by God when they do that, right? So here he says, because he had nobody higher to swear upon, he swore upon himself, right? Who can God swear to? Well, nobody. There's nothing greater than him, right? He's the infinite one. He's the all-powerful one. He's the one that created everything. And so it's crazy to think that there was somebody even greater than him that he could swear by. So he says he swore by himself. He put his own name on the line, and he made this promise to Abraham. Now, when we think about these promises to Abraham, this will be a little bit of a recap if you were here when we started the Christmas message, late November, early December. But for those that didn't, let's think about the promises to Abraham. There's really two main ones, and then the quote here actually comes from Genesis 22 when he sacrificed Isaac. But the first one comes in Genesis 12, right? Genesis 12, we hear about this man named Abram. He's told to leave his homeland and go to this promised land. And there's one big characteristic of that entire promise, the personal pronoun I. All throughout it, God says, I, I'm going to do this. I'm going to multiply you. I'm going to bring you here. And what's the key there? It doesn't say if you do this, Abraham. He says, no, I'm going to do it. God made a promise and it was completely dependent upon himself. See, that ain't how a lot of contracts work. A contract, you got to uphold your end. Abraham didn't have to do that. God said, I'm going to do it. I'm choosing you not because of anything you've done, not because of how good you are, Abraham, but because I'm good. And he's going to call him to this land. Then in Genesis chapter 15, we see it repeated, but then we see something even greater happen. If you recall, at the end of Genesis chapter 15, he tells Abraham to set up a sacrifice. After Abraham has already started to doubt the promise, God repeats the promise to Abram, and then he says, go out, make a sacrifice, kill the animals, split them, and get ready. Now, as the recap for you to remember what that symbolized, what you would do in sealing of that covenant is that you would pass through the animal carcasses. You can imagine the bloody spectacle that it was, but they would pass through the animal carcasses, and what they were saying is, the covenant that I'm making with you, the promise that I'm making with you, if I don't keep it, may I be just like these animals. It was a bold promise. It was a very important thing to say. As we get to this, it's a little bit more in depth, but we see this oath of confirmation. Everybody gave an oath, right? Well, here, he's making this promise. He's passing through these sacrifices. And what happens in Genesis 15? Abraham goes to sleep. It says that God put him to sleep, right? And then we see a fiery smoking pot, which symbolizes God. See, it's awesome, y'all, that our God is so awesome they can't put him into words, right? When we see all these images of God in the Bible, we can get pretty literal and talk about, is this what it looked like? And you'd probably be safe to say that, but one of the big reasons they have to explain it that way in the Scriptures is, how do you describe an undescribable God? He's so infinite, he's so great, he's so awesome. Even when they're trying to describe heaven, I mean, they're using this language and it's just nothing compared to what it truly is, because they can't even utter it, as Paul said. Right? And so we see this smoking pot that symbolizes God, and it passes through the carcasses, and it's as if God's saying then, I swear by myself that if I don't keep my promise to you, Abraham, I'll be like this. But the awesome thing is, something God can't even do is lie. That's what it tells us here, right? For it's impossible for God to lie. When he says a word, he means it, because he swears it upon himself, the unchanging person of God. When he began in Abraham, in Genesis 22, when he tells Abraham to go sacrifice Isaac, the same thing happens. That's the verse you see here where it says, surely I will bless you and multiply you, quoted in verse 14. Abraham goes to sacrifice Isaac. Of course, we know that story. Right when he goes to kill Isaac, God stops him. He praises Abraham for his obedience, but he says, no, no, no. And we get this a little bit from the New Testament, right? No, no, no. There's going to be another son I'm going to send to a hill to die. But it's not yours, Isaac. It's going to be mine. There's going to be a lamb, I'm going to give you a ram, but there's going to be a holy lamb I'm going to give for you. He's going to be a blessing to the nations. He's going to come from your seed, Abraham, but it's not Isaac. And he says, surely I will multiply you. He confirms the promise once again with Abraham. But why? Because of the unchanging person of God. He says, he swears upon himself. He puts his own name on the line. You ever had a friend that just completely changes on you? It happens, unfortunately. I had a friend in high school, and we were almost like brothers. I mean, all the time. He was probably up at my house every day. I'd hear his truck coming. He had big old loud mufflers. You could hear him coming down the road, and he'd pull in. And I'm like, oh, he's here. Nicole would tell you oftentimes, many of our dates in high school, he was third wheeling it. I liked it. We all rode with him, right? And we would... We'd go plenty of places together. He was always, we would either find us maybe playing some video game or shooting pool a lot. We loved to go do that, or going hunting. He did that a lot. So we would do all kinds of stuff together. We were inseparable. Went to church together. He was a big supporter of me when I started in ministry. He was there with me when I was first doing youth ministry. And then something weird happened. When I went to North Carolina for seminary, I knew I was going to be moving 4 hours away. But I was leaving Nicole behind at least for a few months, right? She was staying here while I went up and started school and got things settled and found an apartment so I could actually get married and bring her somewhere, right? And so I went up North Carolina, and that friend actually helped move me, right? Drove the drove the truck, pulled the trailer, moved me in, stayed a weekend. And then after that, never heard again. And not because of anything that I knew that I did, right? I would text him, I just would never get a response. I would call him, I would get the voicemail, and I came home for different holidays and things. I'd try to catch up with him, and I would just never hear from him. And I never understood or never knew why out of nowhere we weren't friends anymore. Maybe you have a similar story to that. Sometimes it can even be family members. The sad thing is, people change. People change. Their thoughts change, their feelings change towards you, and friendships go the way. Right? This is the same reason the friends you have in kindergarten ain't the friends you have in high school, and the friends you have in high school aren't the friends you have in your 20s, and then most of the time, your lifetime friends, there's only like one, and you're lucky if there's two. Why? Things change, but God doesn't. God doesn't change. So when he says, I swear upon myself, there's not going to be a point where God fails himself. He's not going to stop being the truth-giving God and start being the lying God. It's impossible for him to lie. When he says, by my name, I'll keep this promise to you, we can take it to the bank. Now, what does that mean for us? It means that we often like to criticize God because of some feelings we have sometimes. What do I mean by that? Maybe there's certain things in your life, expectations aren't being met the way you feel they should be met. Maybe you don't have the same happiness that you once had. Maybe you don't have that joy of your salvation that you once had. And you start to look at God, you start to blame him for it and think, where did you go? What did you do? Why did you change on me? You used to be so good to me. You used to be close to me. Right now it seems like you're so far away. Sometimes it seems so far away that you don't even know him anymore, right? You have all those feelings running through you, and we start to point the finger at him, and if we were listening to him, he would say, don't blame me. I didn't change. I never changed the way I felt about you. I love you as much as I've ever loved you. I didn't change the promises I made to you. I didn't change the joy that I want you to have. He would say, you probably, you changed. You started making decisions contrary to me. You started to do things you want to do instead of things that I knew you should do because I know what's best for you. But you changed. You started to take steps away from me, and I'm still here. See, God is unchanging. The unchanging purpose, person of God. Not only that, the unchanging purposes of God. God, I love this. Verse 15. And thus Abraham, having patiently waited, obtained the promise. Abraham, having patiently waited, obtained the promise. The reason I pause there to think about that is if you go to Hebrews 11, which we'll be in eventually, if you go to Hebrews 11, you're going to see a list of people that is called the Hall of Faith, the heroes of faith, people that trusted God. And there in Hebrews 11, you're going to see verses where it says, Abraham, though seeing the promise from far off, rejoiced. Not even yet having obtained it. Yeah, we'll talk about this more on Wednesday night if you come, but what I love here is in Hebrews 11, and this comes to this point, Hebrews 11, it literally says concerning Abraham that the foundations of the city that he's seen wasn't Israel, or wasn't Jerusalem, it was a new Jerusalem. And he says he's seen it from afar off. Y'all, he was looking towards our future. And even yet, not having obtained it, he patiently waited. Isn't that us? Isn't that us? Yeah, we got so many things in our headlines and our news that we can look at, and we start to think God's losing ground. I can't stand it when we get to talking like that. God's not losing ground. This is all his creation. I laugh. When we went to the Gatlinburg with the students, and then about a month or so before that, me and Nicole were in Gatlinburg. And if you've ever been to Gatlinburg, you go, you know, out of those little shops. And in that little shop, one of these little shops, you know, it's a coffee shop, overpriced pancake place. And right here, God's corner is what it said, right? And I laughed, and I'm like, he don't just got a corner. He owns all this. That ain't his corn. He owns it all. Right? He's not losing ground. This government's not threatening him, and it, and all of a sudden we're going to get a ruler, and all of a sudden God's going to cease to exist. No, his plans and his purposes are coming to an end. And when we receive the faith that we have in Jesus Christ, y'all, we're looking forward to another city. And a city that's going to come, that's certainly going to come, and we wait, patiently wait for it, even through the midst of hardships. That's what he says here about Abraham. Abraham patiently waited, and he did obtain part of the promise. Right? He made the journey. He didn't have to sacrifice Isaac. He got his promised son, not knowing that there was even going to be a greater one. And I love verse 17. So when God desired to show more convincingly to the heirs of the promise, listen here, the unchangeable character of his purpose, he guaranteed it with an oath. God's purposes aren't tossed aside or changed, it's even because yours are. Sometimes we think too highly of ourselves and think, well, you know what? I ain't doing what God wants me to do. I'll change it. The funny thing is, he knows you. You ain't throwing him off. I love playing board games. Not the best at them, but I love them. Most of the time I like them because I like the mindless board games, the ones where you don't have to pay attention to at all, like Candyland or the game Life or something like that. You don't have to pay attention in life. If you want to win the game of life, go the college path. Some of you might go career, but whatever. And then make sure you have kids, because those kids are worth a lot of money at the end of the game, right? And so you get to the end, and then you retire in the mansion, and you'll have it made, right? So life, that game's really easy, but a lot of the board games, they require a lot of strategy, right? So Monopoly even does, to an extent. Think about it. When you play Monopoly, you roll the dice, you go, you land on a property. You might be on that crummy little first two properties that are like Baltimore Avenue or something like that, and they're purple, and you're like, do I really want to buy that? Because it's only $10, but there's no rent on it. And then you save your money, and you go, and maybe you get over there to Boardwalk and Park Place, and you're starting to decide what you're going to buy, when you're going to buy. And then you got to decide, if I go to jail in the game, right, which is always fun to be the jailkeeper and throw somebody in there and, make sure they got to pay you the money back. Right? If you remember the rules of the game, I think you could pay, $50 to get out of jail. Or you can roll doubles, right? And if you roll doubles, you got three chances, and then you can get out of jail. So you got to decide, is it worth me sitting in jail and not going around this board? Because at least I ain't got to pay rent in jail, right? But I can hang out here, or should I pay $50 because all the other players are starting to buy more properties and do different things. You got little decisions like that. Then you got to decide, do I want to buy a house or a hotel? Or maybe I want to buy both. Maybe I need to sell this land. I can't cover it anymore. I landed on somebody that had Boardwalk. All these little decisions in Monopoly, you can be totally strategic and still lose. Right? The purpose is always the same. You make all these little decisions to win the game, but you can still lose, and one reason you still lose is because you don't control the way the dice land. Right? You're a slave to those things, unless you're a cheater. Right? In which case, you need to play Monopoly Cheaters Edition. Right? But anyways, you're not a friend. You can't roll the dice. You're not controlling that, and yet still, even if we could, we're not even as good in the little minor details and decisions we would have to make to win a game of Monopoly. To think of how terrified I'd have to be if I truly thought I was the captain of my life. I don't want it. I don't want it. Because here's the thing, the one we trust, he does control the way the dice land. The one we trust, the one we put our faith in, has unchangeable purposes. The plans he have reach completion. And when we put our faith in him, there's not a if, and, or but about it. It's knowing he's going to do what he said he's going to do, because it's impossible for God to lie. His word doesn't return void. His word is good. It's solid. And what does that mean? It means, y'all, that God, he's not just over everything, if he is. He's not just over everything, but that he actually cares and is still God in the moments of your life as well. Some of the small decisions you make in a game of Monopoly can matter, And yet they don't matter that much because at the end of the thing, you lose and you flip the board over and you're like, it's just a stupid game, right? And you hide it or you move stuff around because you've been playing for 4 hours, right? You wasted your day. No. When it's all said and done, that doesn't matter. But even those small decisions matter. God is with you in the small decisions. God is the God of your moments as well as the God of your days as well as the God of your weeks because He's also the God of your eternity. And His purposes hold true. And then, y'all, the final point here. He's an anchor for our soul. I love this. Look at verse 18. We'll be in there, and we'll read to the last two verses. He says, so that by two unchangeable things, God's person and His purposes, who He is and what He says, in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have fled for refuge might have strong encouragement to hold fast to the hope set before us. We have this as a sure and steadfast anchor of the soul, a hope that enters into the inner place behind the curtain where Jesus has gone as the forerunner on our behalf, have become a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. I read this. I thought it was awesome. When it says, those who have fled for refuge, the phrase fled for refuge suggests the Old Testament cities of refuge. If you know what those are, I'm about to explain it to you. It's described in Numbers 35 and Joshua 20. God appointed six cities, three on each side of the Jordan, into which a man could flee if he had accidentally killed someone. The elders of the city would investigate the case. If they determined that it was indeed manslaughter and not murder, they would permit the man to live in the city until the death of the high priest. Then he could return home. The members of the slain man's family could not avenge themselves so long as the man remained in the city. You get that? So they had these refuge cities. If it was manslaughter, you're protected. Now, why would you need to be protected? Because sometimes a family don't care whether it's manslaughter or not, and they were going to come get them. And so they had to flee for refuge into these cities, and they would watch them and protect them until the death of the high priest. Y'all, we have fled to Jesus Christ. He's our eternal refuge, and as our high priest, He will never die. And we have eternal salvation. No avenger can touch us because He's already died and risen from the dead. And then it says we have this firm anchor for our soul. Now, didn't I tell you there's a great encouragement that comes here at the end of chapter 6 versus some of the serious warning that comes at the beginning of chapter 6. Right? It gets kind of scary at the beginning of chapter 6, and you don't know why is he saying stuff that's so hard? And I'm sure these Hebrew believers thought the same thing. Remember how the last verses of chapter 6, verses 1 through 12 started. So verses 11 through 12 up there. If you recall, after he gives this serious warning, he then goes on to tell them, believers, I believe you're saved, is basically what he says. He says, I believe you're saved. I don't think that the serious warning I just gave you applies to you. And if that's true, then 13 through 20, what we've just read is true. He says, I'm going to be an anchor for you. We have this sure and steadfast anchor of the soul. Now, what is the sure and steadfast anchor of the soul? He describes it, a hope that enters into the inner place behind the curtain where Jesus has gone as a forerunner on our behalf. Of course, you got to know a little bit of the Old Testament history here and the way the tabernacle was set up to understand what he's even talking about here. Just briefly, you have the outer court. You have the inner court. Then you have the holy place where they would have incense and sacrifices and different things that took place. The priests would do a lot of work there. That's where most of the sacrifices that they offered would be on a regular basis. But then, inside even this tent, there was the holy place, but then there was a veil. And behind that veil was the Holy of Holies. The Holy of Holies was where God was. Now, of course, we know God is everywhere. He was even then, too. He was never confined to a box. He was never trapped in a tent. He was God for the Jews, even in exile, as much as He was when they were there in the tabernacle or with the temple, wherever they were. But that was a special place that He had designed that they were to come, and they could only come. The high priest could do it. He could only do it one time a year, and that's the only time he could enter into that veil. and make sacrifices for the entire world, the entire nation. Right? He would make atonement for his nation. But if you went in any other time, you died. Why? Because God's glory is so great and his holiness is so great, it can't stand the presence of sin. And we're all sinners. And so you couldn't come in any other time, but he made it a time where they could come in. And y'all, that's where God is. And when we think back to what Jesus did on the cross and why it was so significant, if you recall what happens up to the crucifixion, the veil's torn. The veil was torn from top to the bottom because the boundary that stopped you from getting to God was broken because his body was broken. And now through him you have access to God. So when it says, here's the firm anchor for your soul, the hope that got in behind the inner curtain, the very truth that you can have presence with God, that you can be with him, that he can say, you're mine, and you can say, I'm yours. The reason you can have that relationship, it's because of what Jesus did on the cross. And he says, I've came before you. I'm the forerunner. I bring you into this inner place. And now you can have eternal relationship with God. The thing that Adam and Eve lost can be yours again because of what he did for you on the cross. It's an anchor, y'all. It holds firm through the storm. I think, like, when we think of anchor, most of the time we probably think of a boat. But one thing I also think of when I think of an anchor is climbing, rock climbing. Any crazy people rock climb? Don't let me know, because I will call you stupid, right? Don't rock climb. But I would never do it, but I've seen people do it. And what do? They got the pulley systems, if they're really smart, right? Some people just go out there and don't wear anything. But the smart people have a pulley system, and they're climbing, and their bare hands, and their boots, or whatever they got, kind of shoes they got on. And when they get to a point in the rock, what do? They get these things they can jam into the rock that are anchors. Jam one here, get up, jam another one up there. And what does it do? It's if a rock breaks or your foot slips, you're anchored right there. You're only going to fall so far. I thank the Lord that he's an anchor for my soul. I've shared this before, but one of my favorite hymns is Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing. And I love that hymn. It's awesome. And I especially love the last verse, right? When he goes, prone to wonder, Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. Here's my heart, Lord, take and seal it. Seal it for thy courts above. I don't know if you are good at lying to yourself. Sometimes we get good at lying to ourselves, especially when we're having a bad day. Maybe that's a good thing. But one thing it's bad to be lying about yourself about is to think that you're so good that you would have chose Jesus any day of the week had he not come seeking you. That's a lie. The Bible says your heart and my heart was distant from him, and that he came for us. And he loved us before we ever loved him. And then another thing that can be very prideful and we lie to ourselves about is this thought that, well, now that I'm saved, I would never turn my back on him. Boy, there's a lot of stories in the Bible that say different. And yet, he's still faithful. And yet, when he says, I made a promise to you, and even though you may drift away from me every now and then, and you start to slip up because you're being a dummy, I'm only going to let you fall so far because you're mine. You're not going to fall to your death because I've already given you life. You've got an anchor for your soul. And it's in Christ and Christ alone. I laughed when I was writing this up because I told Nicole, I said, this is going to be probably one of the most traditional Southern Baptist sermons I could have ever written. Why? Because it's 3 points in a poem. I'm going to end with a poem, but I thought it was very fitting. We'll end with this poem. We'll offer an invitation. We're going to sing. But this is what it says. It says, I can feel the anchor fast as I meet each sudden blast. And the cable, though unseen, bears the heavenly strain between. Through the storm I safely ride till the turning of the tide, and it holds, my anchor holds. Blow your wildest, then, O gale, O my bark so small and frail, by his graces I shall not fail, for my anchor holds, my anchor holds.